Welcome to the Investors First Podcast, a service of CFA Society Orlando. We're here to educate investors, advisors, and consultants through conversations with some of the top finance and investment professionals from around the world. Learn more about us at cfasociety.org/Orlando.
Our guest today is Professor Tamar Frankel, a longtime member of the Boston University School of Law faculty, who writes extensively and teaches in the areas of fiduciary law, corporate governance, mutual funds, and the regulation of financial systems. In 2013, the Institute for Fiduciary Standard established the annual Frankel Fiduciary Prize in her honor to award individuals advancing fiduciary principles. In today's episode, Tamar explains what led her to spend her career focusing on fiduciary law and what it means to be a fiduciary. We talk about conflicts of interest within the advisory space and what regulatory suggestions she has to help eliminate them. We discuss topics of trust, honesty, and kindness, and why we would all benefit more if we focus more on those. Today's episode is hosted by me, Chris Cannon, and she really is one of the greats. I hope you enjoy. So I remember us meeting in Philadelphia, and I believe it was 2016. And a friend of ours told me that he purposely set me at your table because he thought we might have a lot to talk about. So I remember sitting across from you. It was at a restaurant in Philadelphia. I remember that at the end of the evening, you and I were the only two left in the room. So that's what I remember. And the next day, we were over in the big facility where they were having the conference portion. You walked up to me and you put your hands on my face. You said, "Tell me what makes you tick. What is it that really motivates you? Why do you do what you do?" And I said, "You know, I've given that a lot of thought. I like being present and particularly responsible for people when they have their aha moments." You said, "Well, what did your parents do?" And I said, "Well, they were teachers." And she said, "Oh, well, you come by it honest then." That's what I remember about us meeting. And ever since then, I've been running around a fan of yours. So just so you know, you have fans out there.
Thank you so much. I want to edit none of it.
So I'll start with the first question, because there are a lot of people that do know who you are. But one of my hopes is that people who don't and aren't familiar with you or your work will be introduced to you in this podcast interview. So would you talk about where you were born and where'd you grow up?
I was born in Israel. I lived there for about 30 years, and I continued to visit Israel for many years after that, especially when Israel was experiencing a war. And I had parents. I had a brother. He was in the army. So there were good reasons to go private, but also public. I belonged there.
I also understand you were in the Israeli Air Force. Is that right?
That was correct. I was a legal advisor to the Air Force for a relatively short time when it was small, but I was in the, quote, Air Force in the underground also.
So when you entered law school, did you have any sort of designs or intent to pursue fiduciary law? What was your path to becoming a fiduciary specialist lawyer?
I did not think about fiduciary law at the time. I lived it. It is a very different kind of entry. It is the value of knowing whom to trust and whom not to trust, because the power and the punishment of trusting the wrong person could be death. So you develop a system or a feeling of whom you can trust, as well as the reality. And that is really what I have done. The other thing, as a result of it, my father was a lawyer and he ended up being the president of the Israeli bar. But he was a lawyer in a Germanic way. There was no maybe it, maybe not, maybe yes, maybe no. There was right and there was not right. And that was the end of the discussion. And I think to some extent, I inherited that, if not in my genes, then in my being with him and talking to him so much.
Are there any tells that you've developed that you would be willing to share about how to know who and or when to trust someone?
Well, sometimes you may know more than the other person, but the other person makes the assumption. He's an expert, and therefore you don't know. And that was a good example. There was a salesman who came to our home and offered, that was already in the United States, and offered a variable annuity. Very few people knew about it. I wrote my doctoral thesis for Harvard Law School on variable annuities. And he began to give us how wealthy we will become forever and ever a day. I couldn't help it. Usually I'm not that cruel, but I began to ask him specifics. And the moment he saw where I was leading, he said, "Excuse me," he put on the hat and he went out. And that was the experience where I thought to myself, how other people who would not know what the word means, let alone the fat knowledge, a lot of detailed knowledge that you have to know, because it's a combination of two systems. Each system is sufficiently complex. I learned that you have to trust, but also that sometimes you can't say, okay, learn it by yourself. You can't.
So it sounds like one of the skills you developed was to try to get someone to talk about something that you do actually have some knowledge about, but they don't know. So that the other person thinks that there is information asymmetry, and that might reveal their character in some way.
Most clients, for example, are offered variable annuities or something of this sort, or even securities. They know it as shares, but they don't know the word securities. These people must rely, and there is no way in which they can find out. So trust in this particular case is crucial to the very transaction and to the very system of securities regulation or securities trading, if we want to have one. If we don't have to have one, then the result may be enormous harm, as it was to the investors, but in the long run, also to the entire system and everybody who worked in it.
I was going to ask you if you could tell me what fiduciary means, just in general, for people who maybe aren't as familiar with the term, what a fiduciary is.
Well, a fiduciary is a person who, at least with respect to what advice or action he orders to another, is trustworthy, is doing it for the person who does not know but needs certain service. Doctors are of this sort. If I go to a doctor and he gives me a heart surgery, I cannot be sure. I cannot even understand what he's doing, and I'm under narcotics. I can't even know. But I can die. So this is a very good example of what happened when one surgeon, in the middle of surgery, was called by the broker because he had to put more money, otherwise his stocks would be sold. So he left the surgery and went to pay. The client, he probably left there an assistant, whoever. And the client didn't die, but he was finished as a doctor for life. That was the end. And that gives a very good example of what he should have done. To hell with the money.
Given your experience as being an astute observer of the financial services industry, particularly here in the United States, what is your current assessment as a professor? What grade would you give the United States right now around the financial services industry and its recognition and compliance with all things fiduciary?
You know, this is an answer that wraps in both yes and however. And so I would separate the two. there are people in the financial, and I wouldn't call it industry. They produce nothing except advice. And so it's service. It's not a thing. It is a way of behavior and help of others. So I would say that some of them are very, very particular about identifying their advice with that of the client in two ways. One, they must really know, sometimes work very hard. If you're an expert witness, I know you work very hard, even though you are an expert, about learning the particular situation. And second, having no conflict of interest, except what the client really knows, and that is the payment by the client, no one else. We call it the duty of care, meaning becoming an expert, and the duty of loyalty, meaning you have only one client. Now, what if you do have conflict? Then the solution is to ask the client, look, I'm being paid by X to sell it to Y, even though I'm giving you advice about Y. Yes? Do you understand my relationship to X is he's my son-in-law? Yes? Once you do that and the client says, never mind, I know him also, you are fine, and then I agree, that's okay. But if I don't tell him that, I shouldn't be able to do it. That is the conflict of interest. And these are really the two duties that an expert should have, being an expert and being an expert only for the client and no one else, unless the client agrees but is also able to agree.
Do you see things right now in the financial advice and advice delivery as being something that cycles that you've seen where it gets worse and it gets better? And does it always take some sort of crisis for us to respond? Or what is your assessment?
Well, I look at history first, because then I have facts, not in the future, but then I have only kind of trying to find out myself, imagination. In the past, there came a point where the financial system crashed, either fully, as in the 30s or 20s, 30s, or even partially throughout the time. And I would say that in all of these situations, there was fraud. And it started not with a big one, but slowly, this is okay, this may not be okay, and so on. The last one, which we are still struggling with now, is the demand for specificity. Law becomes a dictionary. Here is 1,000 pages of what a broker should or should not do in order to be fiduciary or trustworthy. And then the interpretation is not what the source of the problem is, but the dictionary. And therefore, after 1,000 pages, you'll be surprised how many other situations occur that are not covered by this. So give me specifically what I should do, and then everything else is free. We are a free country, aren't we? This is the worst possible way in which I saw throughout the years crashes really occurred finally. When did they occur finally? When the people didn't believe, but en masse. And then they withdrew their money en masse, and there was nothing left except the brokers themselves. Not only brokers. In the 30s, there were a lot of economists who fell into that group.
Are you saying that it's when the pendulum of the surrounding issues and the regulatory regimes and even the public acceptance, and that pendulum swings far more to rules-based type approaches as opposed to principles-based approaches, is that coincidental with the problems that develop and then ultimately cause problems?
we need both. We need the generality, and then we need some examples. And then in the generality and in the examples, we need the core. Why would we do it, for heaven's sake? If I meet some friend whom I like very much, but she looks awful, and I say, oh my God, you are so beautiful. I lie, but I didn't harm. Lies can be very generous. So the issue is not right or not correct or correct. The issue is the trustworthy, not even the trustworthiness. She trusts me, she feels much better. Yes? But it is when I do something which really is conflicting with my advice to you. Conflicting, not in general, conflicting in your interest. When we come to the end of the story, it is we can't live alone. We depend on others. And therefore, our dependence, if we can't do it by ourselves, then that's a different story. But if we depend on others for what we need, they must be trustworthy to identify with our interests, not with theirs. If they can't, they have to tell us that. And then we have to decide, provided we know the language and we understand and we have our hearing.
So do you think that the most recent SEC commissioner, do you feel like he understood the framework as you do? Or does he just have a completely different understanding of how this works? Because it seems to me that what you were referencing earlier, which is Reg BI of 1,000+ pages, these explicitly enumerated items that you can't do without any real explanation or examples of the framework in a principles-based way. Is that because he was a lawyer of some particular variety? I mean, did they get it and they just were trying to accomplish an agenda, or did they just not understand it?
Well, first of all, he and many others are very smart. So I would eliminate that. But you have a different view of the world and a different view of what truth is and what trust means. And because what I suggest maybe has nuances, those who are in the area say, tell me yes, tell me no. Don't give me a little bit of this, a little bit of that. Trust is not tell me yes, tell me no. It's impossible because it depends also on the recipient, how much he does understand. That's the story that I gave you now with variable annuities.
Yeah, it seems the facts and circumstances aspect always makes it not very palatable to lawyers, right? Lawyers want very clear lines. General counsels want very clear delineation. This is good. This is legal. This is bad. This is not legal. And that's not offered, I guess, in a true fiduciary framework that requires evaluation of the facts and circumstances.
May I humbly disagree with assumption of what lawyers really want?
Yes.
Lawyers are not mathematicians, but even mathematicians have problems with a number, because a number may depend on what other numbers are around it. And so the good lawyers go to really the principle, instinctively go to the principle. Bad lawyers are those who say, I know what the principle is, now let me go around it and let me tell you, you can do it this way, that way, and so on. So when those bad lawyers, what they are doing is not knowing what good is. They want simply to look the other way and to eliminate that good. We are not talking about details. We are talking about principles in both ways, in both camps, if you will. But in the camp that I'm objecting to is the demand to do it in such a way that a way around it can be found, because that's where the specificity demand comes.
Perhaps one of the foundational issues around organizing any regulatory regime or even any society is to try and support and ensure that the general culture is honest. that people can be trusted, and whether that be trust in the news that you're getting through, you know, the television or radio or reading in a newspaper, or what your advisor is saying. So I guess my question is, how is it possible now in this day and age that anyone could say that they are both an advisor and a broker?
You can. It's not easy, but the advisor should then have inside him or her the ability to look to only to the needs of the client and not think, oh, I can then trade more and get money more. In other words, the rewards for honesty may not come only from money. And that, I want to tell you, people who cook well don't cook less well because they could get something. On the contrary, their reward is when the customer says, oh, this is so good. That is their reward. People in this country, as well as everywhere else, can get rewards in another way, even by money. The question of control or self-regulation is very large. And I found a former student of mine, as a matter of fact, who told me the following, that instead of having, or in addition, but instead, or let me add one more thing, that if within the institution, there's somebody who sees something wrong and goes to the boss and tells them this is wrong, he's a snitch. And as a result of it, he's a variety. They don't want to deal with him. He is gone. Well, snitches are no good. However, what they have done is given the requirement for self-regulation to the middle management, not to somebody, the police. And the middle management is also very aware of where things may be. Those who come and say, I goofed, I made a mistake, I lost $100,000, they notify that. At the end of the year, those who came forward and said, I goofed, get a reward. They control themselves. And their bosses get a reward too. It costs the corporation far less. This was an insurance company, far less than anything else. So you can reward for honesty. And I think this is a system that we ought to accept and practice.
Given that we're all flawed humans, susceptible to all kinds of influences, that maybe just as a human behavior aspect of trying to create good policy, we not only try to eliminate our conflicts, particularly with our clients, we also try to create some incentives to reward.
That's correct.
I think that's an example of a policy fix, but in kind of a political real world framework, if you got to be the philosopher queen of the world and or the United States, what would you do, say, here in the United States on a policy approach to improve the way that things are organized?
I don't want to go into politics, but I will. Leadership means a lot. People follow admired leader. They follow first, then they admire what he does or she does later. So political leaders, teachers, anybody with whom one works, but who has authority, if they show a model, it will be followed. So this is one thing. And that's why I told you, and I'm going to put it right here. When you look at the virus, that is how they succeed. Each of them doesn't, nothing. But together, they succeed because they have, well, unfortunately for us, they have instinctive and genetic leadership, and they go, sometimes you have to die for the right thing or for the wrong thing. That is one. The other is maybe go back to the schools. And I didn't put it down anywhere, but I really believe that in each low class schools, the issue of honesty should be a theme, not necessarily a class with grades, but a theme. is that really a nice thing to do? Not even use the word, the big words. A nice thing to do? If you see that somebody's falling, is it a nice thing to help, get up, or laugh at it? What is nice? And I believe that this country would be enriched by this type that starts very early. The way I started, in a different environment, but the same thing. In Swedish culture at the time, I don't know what it is now, was of that sort. It was rigid, but there were so many things that you simply did not do. This is one example. I think there are smaller communities in which that exists. There are various gradations of honesty as well. So some countries have more of it, some countries have less of it. Where I was born and raised, among us with a group, it was 1,000%. There were very, very few who did it, except those who came from other countries. You had that kind of trustworthiness. But of course, you had also some competition, some this, some that. But it never, never, never reached the core. Let me add one more thing, and that is I'm now working with someone about culture and law. But I want to add to it, how do you create a culture of honesty? How do you create it, not in a group, but simply we don't do it here, my dear. And you learn it from a very early age. You don't do it, or you do this. So I think America may benefit from it.
So one of the things that I was reading and we've talked about is how your studies and your focus around fiduciary duty arose at least in part from some of the gaps that you saw in contract law.
I would say that it comes much earlier, but you're right. When I go to a doctor, I do have a contract. I have an agreement. I'll pay so and so and get that and that. So the answer is it's about an interaction that includes contract. But in contract law, and I do mention that there's a difference. There are parts of the past, the assertion of facts that have occurred, and they must be true. But there are also promises of the future. And those promises depend to some extent on whether things have not changed to make my contract either too good or too bad. So in that case, sticking with the contract, sticking with the agreement becomes also a question of trustworthiness. That is true. Why do people breach contracts less? Because it's less specific than a service of a fiduciary. A contracting party is not a fiduciary. By the way, there is a story about a man in a concentration camp in Europe who was dying of hunger, and somebody from outside, do you know the story? Somebody from outside came and said, if you pay me after you are released $25,000, I will give you some food. And he said, I promise. And he got a loaf of bread, which he ate, and afterwards managed to break out. When he came back to America, that man sued him because he did not want to pay the $25,000. And he said, this is a contract. And the answer of the court was, it is not. When two people are in such differences, either of knowledge, in this case, of simply hardship, that is not a contract. And he won. So this is another range.
Interesting. So there's a presumption of a different kind of contract, I guess, and then there are requirements that need to be met.
Well, the requirements is also a contract that is signed by a person who doesn't read and doesn't have eyes is no contract. Also by a child is no contract. So there must be some equality, which does not happen in fiduciary. And that's the difference between a contract. in contract law, it must be more or less equal.
So the analogy here is that when someone who is a fiduciary in financial services is speaking with and engaging into an agreement with their client, what the client doesn't even know or understand is that they are in duress, in a sense, because of the information asymmetry, and aware of their position of duress.
The only difference is that then the broker or the advisor cannot sue for his pay. But I want more than that. I need the advisor to be honest. Our system needs it.
So one of the other things you mentioned from your period of growing up and your formative years in, I guess I'll call them in Israel, is that when you were practicing law over there, you developed a couple of little things that helped you understand what the client's state of mind was and what their ability to even understand the issues were. And one of the things you mentioned was that when clients tell you it's convenient or inconvenient, can you explain that?
A client signed the contract and it had to be notarized. The other party wanted, instead of a notary public, which we have here, you went to the law court and there was somebody there who, now in order to make sure that the people who put their John Hancock on the paper understood what they were doing, they wanted a lawyer. So I went with a client from another country who sold a very large piece of land for a lot of money. And he did it through an irrevocable power of attorney so that the buyer could then sell it to somebody else without being a buyer. And that was a way that was known. But we went to, instead of notary public, we went to a law court who did the same thing. But I had to verify the materials in that statement were very complex and so on. It wasn't simply, I agree that Mr. So-and-so will have the land. It was much more than that. So he looked at me and he said, if it is convenient, because that means if he has offers for a better price, yes, then I did not understand then that he is free to sell it to the other one. If it's not convenient, okay. So I was the one who was to decide, because the court officer was not. Yes, I was the one to tell them. And so I did. I told them, go back. He said, no. I said, yes. And we went back. I had it all translated into Arabic, which was his language, and read it. And I stood there. And now I'm going to say that you understood. And of course, he didn't want that. He was able to say, ma'baraf. I don't understand.
Really, the only context I think that I even have any sort of ability to even think about what the environment was like when you started out is that Ruth Bader Ginsburg movie, the types of men, the types of belief systems, and I guess in many ways, kind of, you know, like you said, the culture.
There were also six women students. I mentioned that, but that is also something. It went both ways, both the students. And by the way, the last two deans of Boston University Law School are women. And believe me, they don't burst into crying. If somebody bursts into crying, it's not there.
There are still many male-dominated fields of professions. I think financial services is still very, you know, male-dominated. Is there any advice that you might have for women who are just now starting to come up in that field, or for women who are in the field and want to, you know, advance in these different roles?
Number one, the focus should be on the professional services. The moment you show that being a woman is important for you, it is also becomes important for them. But if being a woman is not important for you, then it doesn't really matter. The second, or maybe the first one, is be good and contribute, be a professional and contribute to the institution. As much as the men want to be direct from God, yes, they want the institution to be successful. If you bring them success, they will do anything, anything. And to some extent, you must be then, unfortunately, at the beginning at least, better than anybody else. You must show what you can contribute. The fact that I wrote that treatise and it went to the law review, it became a bestseller because it didn't exist anywhere else, and lawyers wanted to know what variable annuities is instead of saying, huh. And so the result was that the law review was inundated with readers, not merely readers, with buyers. You can't then say, oh, she's stupid. You can't. So you have to be good, but not competitive. You have to be good not in the area that they do, in your own, and you have your own strength that they don't have. I had a crazy benefit from having an accent. I spoke English in a Hebrew accent that made me different, but it made me also interesting. I think so.
Oh, I agree. So what this makes me think of is that just like with how you arrived at where you are and who you are, you had a lot of personal experiences that shaped you, as did I. So for example, I believe that one of the reasons that I am or have been called a militant fiduciary activist.
Compliments, yes.
Well, yes, that's right. They were hurling compliments at me, thinking that they were hurting me. But one of those is because I've seen so many things that were just wrong in my experiences being in this industry. I saw people violating their fiduciary duties in all kinds of different ways. And what I notice is that there are, you could almost group the different violations that I've seen in the past, and they just keep cropping up in different versions. Where I'm going with all this is, since I've seen people taking winning trades and giving losing trades to others, or I've seen, you know, people just lie or misrepresent things just to get a transaction or a sale, I guess that's really for me. But one of the things that I've always glommed onto was how so much of the policy and so much of the framework, it seems to me, gets down to that idea of identifying and trying to avoid the conflicts. From day one, I always thought of the story of the, and I never say this right, as I don't know if it's Ring of Gyges or Ring of Gyges in Plato's Republic, where the most pious man in the country, who was also a shepherd, which I always found fascinating that he was a shepherd, you know, finds a crack in the earth and there's this ring that gives him the power of invisibility. And by the end of the story, he has, you know, killed the king and married the queen. The point being is that tending the house of a good framework and functioning system of fiduciary is really maintained by the process of identifying and mitigating conflicts of interest. It seems to me, and I'm asking you this, I guess, as I talk, this is your interview and here I am talking. It seems to me that that is the part that starts to become accepted by the regulatory regime, the legal framework, maybe even the case decisions, and then the culture, that it all stems from nobody's pulling the conflict of interest weeds in their garden. Would you say that I that my weird experience that turned me into this militant that I believe is defined by that, would you say that there's something to what I'm seeing or what I believe now, which is that this is all around people either not understanding or misrepresenting or covering up or trying to allow more conflicts of interest to just stick around or be acceptable?
No, it's not acceptable. Not only that, I think it's the real poison of any group and any culture. But it comes also from, with all due respect, it comes from the idea that competition makes the entire group or the entire country wealthier. It doesn't. Not this kind of competition. I believe that empathy and this identification is greater, a greater incentive. It gives also a feeling that even if I am a small unit, I'm part of a huge unit, instead of I'm going to be the top and I'm going to make everybody less than I am. I am the center of the universe. You're not. I think what you're doing is the right thing to do. But the idea that being good and being giving is your loss is a wrong one. It's your gain. And therefore, I have to add my own experience. I come to a country where I don't have the language, I don't have the culture. I stick to idea that everybody thinks she's a bit, you know, something is wrong with her, you know, yes? Instead of contract, she brings in fiduciary. What is it? Yes? It takes time, some persistence, and it takes, to some extent, knowledge. You can't simply do it otherwise. And the result is, I'll tell you what has happened to something I wrote in 48, the first article on fiduciary law. It's all over the world. I couldn't believe it. I still get all of a sudden from, you name it. So you get it. It is a process. It takes time. You can't expect change. But the one thing is, I believe in some either action or better still in writing, because that can move around better and that can be then addressing more people. But I found it all of a sudden in England, in you name it, everywhere. And the same thing applies. I wrote a little book review, Why Do People Lie? The book interested me, so I wrote the book review. You know who the main readers, not of the book, I don't know, but of the book review? People in Venezuela. Do I know a friend in Venezuela was going to sell it? No. You find that there is a need. Find the need and give some rationale, some help, some something that is valuable. And what you find then, that it has legs of its own. If you want it immediate, no. You can't change a culture immediate. You can't change even a group immediate. But if you do it without any pressures will come, push away, go away, then you will succeed. Because there is a need for that. I believe that.
So given what you've observed in history, I mean, you recently wrote a piece talking about the regulatory regime here in the United States and their conflict of interests and how the commission has become politicized and the conflicts that are influencing the regulatory regime and the corrosive nature that those conflicts have played. Are we in just a historical cycle where there is a slow, corrosive creep of conflicts until something blows up and there's a crisis and then we have to respond? Is that just what we're relegated to? We have to just watch this historical dynamic play out again? Or is there hope we might be able to do something preemptively or prophylactically the next crisis?
Let me add, I didn't mean to bring it up, but it is too close. I'm finishing now an article about not the United States, but the disunited states. And one of the reasons is our assumption that if you win against someone, you are really better. Wrong. It depends how you win and how you bring what your relationship with the other is. There is in this culture the assumption that if somebody is better than you or you help him, then you undermine yourself. That is a rot of a whole country, that if you push somebody down, you will go up, or you are up. It's wrong. You go down with them. And so I think it's a question of, in America, a question of culture. Talent, there is plenty of talent. You can't imagine. Culture, I think we can learn from the virus, but we can also learn from others. The time has come for us to begin to think of us, not I. That's the other side of it.
I think it's interesting that a lot of people talk about, well, competition will do this, but to me, it's not just the competition. It's this notion that there's not a fair playing field. It's when people use their fiduciary status in reality to take advantage, that there's more of a what can I get away with approach. It's not what's the right way.
But also, there is no right way that is specific and everything else is permissible. That's not the way you think about it. The right way is in you and you. Are you a person of right way from head to toe, not what you do, to whom you do, when you do? All of that is irrelevant. Are you that kind of a person? If you are not, then you may do nice things here and not nice things here. You are the poison of this country. And I think, unfortunately, because of, again, the culture of what we believe is right, or many believe is right, then we are ruining our own culture. America is ruining itself. The interesting part is, when I look at China, I have visiting scholars who came and chose me. And one of them is the son of a person who runs a big, big city, that means the governor of a city. So they had money to send him here to be you, and he chose me of all people. But I understood why. Because he wanted to help, to get help from the poor farmers. How do you get help from the poor farmers? You know, I sent him to read about what the kibbutz is. Kibbutz doesn't get handout. They help each other. They sell together, not each, in competition. And they were, so we talked about a variety of ways in which people interact. Talked about banks that are together, not owned. Yes, but by the owners and so on. What I'm suggesting is there is no rule for America. There is maybe a culture for America to change, to become united in the state, not to get from others, but united in order to help each other. I think, again, it's the virus. Let us be like the virus. The idea of competition, you know, when you think about sports and how many people it killed and how many people, and you enjoy the fact that you won and you don't think about the others, well, what is kind? There are other kinds of sports in which people can do sport. But they play tennis, and afterwards they shake hands and you say, good play. The British do that, and I think to this very day. Then the person who lost has a feeling he participated in a good play. Whether he lost or won, it doesn't matter. It was a good play. We have forgotten, or perhaps didn't know enough, about a good play. And the time has come for it.
We have one question that we ask of everyone that we have on the podcast, and that is, if you could interview someone, anyone in the world, who would that be?
I would ask someone who is one of many, not a leader, not because I know the answers. And I want from people, I don't know the answers. What makes you happy in this America? What makes you miserable in this America? What makes you furious in this America? And now put it all on China. I want to know other countries. How do you see the world? As a matter of fact, my questions will not be in order to influence, but in order to find out. I want to learn more. This is a huge country with a variety, but not as much as we think. Yes, a variety of ideas and feelings and sources. And if we could make a map of all that variety and put the plus and the minus to four or five main questions, yes or no, then we will get really a sense of where the strength is, where the weakness is, and where is maybe is. And then I would go to the maybes. I would look for people who have that tendency and who love to give and see the other people smile. It can be a joke. It doesn't have to be money. It can be a story. It can be, aha, really? Let us try and do that on a large scale. And that can be done on a large scale. It should start, not start, but it should include the teachers. It should include the schools. But it should include the leaders.
I too long for the days when collectively we realize, you know, even what the evidence has led us to, which is people get the most self-satisfaction out of gifts that they give.
But I want the gift to be personal. I want the gift to be behavior, not giving money, not giving something, not giving my shoes. I want to behave in a way that is giving. Then I change.
I can't thank you enough for sharing all this time.
Thank you.
I've been told you're not particularly good at taking compliments, but I also want you to know how very much you mean to so many people that have been taught by you and inspired by you and what you do. And you should hear that at least 20 times a day.
No, be careful. Be careful. You tell me that too many times. Thank you. Thank you. That is the best gift I can get. Thank you.
You've been listening to the Investors First Podcast, a service of CFA Society Orlando. If you haven't yet, go ahead and subscribe to this podcast so you never miss an episode. You can also learn more about each episode and the society itself at cfasociety.org/Orlando/podcast. Thank you, and we'll see you next time on the Investors First Podcast. All opinions expressed by podcast participants are solely their own and do not reflect the opinion of their firm. This podcast is not intended to provide expert advice on topics covered and should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions. If you need tax, accounting, or legal advice, please consult a professional.